supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for joining us for this very special program. The story of the Boston bombings has become one that most of us are painfully familiar with. Many of us were riveted to our TV sets and computers as we watched explosions, mayhem, lockdowns, and a manhunt all in real time. The story unfolded before our eyes through every major news provider imaginable, from Facebook and Twitter to the New York Times, even our own newsworks. We were transfixed and on edge. At the time, we were all Bostonians. We were all frightened, and we were all vulnerable. Now, at a time when authorities continue to create timelines, sift through evidence, interrogate bombing suspect number two, citizens are told to resume their normal lives. But how can that be done when so many of us feel so vulnerable still?
I don't know that it's a new feeling of vulnerability. I've always recognized that random actions can be taken. It's happenstance.
It's a concern in the family because we think it could be the beginning of a new trend of copycats.
I'm a parent, and it makes you question the activities you take your kids to.
Turning on the TV and hearing the words catastrophe and disaster, and it just makes you want to go back to bed.
My family lives in Boston, and indeed I have a brother who's at MIT who knew the policeman that was killed and, of course, was in lockdown on Friday in his apartment. And so I was actually in constant contact with him to see how things were.
Watching over and over again the explosions, the carnage that was released on the marathon runners who were there to have fun and to... they were American.
I have friends in Boston. So it was scary when they would post on Facebook, like, Emerson is on lockdown, can't leave the dorms.
It can happen here. Who's to say we're exclusive? This is a historical area, so we're a target.
You worry about sort of overreaction and the militarization of the country. So it could have that kind of negative effect.
Well, it's a scary thing when you think about that these things can happen anywhere at any time and that we don't have controls for them because they're so unpredictable.
I guess it really, it would make me think twice about going to social gatherings like that, but I don't think it would stop me, really.
The Boston bombing will make me more circumspect when I'm in groups.
Anybody could be a victim of terror. There isn't that sense of it couldn't happen to me. You just really don't know. It just makes you appreciate life a lot more.
Thanks to Jennifer Lynn for that collection of sentiments about what impact what happened in Boston last week had on all of us. And that's what I want to do on today's show. I want to take a look at this sensation, this phenomenon of vulnerability that we just heard. And I want to do this in a way that helps us move forward and understand what it might take to transcend, if that's even the right word, to deal with, handle this national trauma. Lucky for me, I'm in good company. I'm joined by a live studio audience right here in the studio. Welcome, everybody.
Yeah.
Welcome. Yeah. And I'm also joined by a dear friend and an expert on trauma, psychiatrist Steve Berkowitz. Steve, welcome.
Thank you, Dan.
Steve's an associate professor of clinical psychiatry at the University of Pennsylvania, director of the Penn Center for Youth and Family Trauma Response and Recovery. And I do appreciate your pitching in on such a short notice. Steve and I are going to talk about what happened a bit, but we'd really like to hear from all of you here in the studio and in the larger audience. I want to know what impact this had on you personally. You know, when someone comes into my office, the first question I have is, what happened to you? What did it mean? What are you carrying as a result of what you experienced last week? You and your family. And shortly we'll take your questions and comments from our live audience and from our listening audience. As always, our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. So, Steve, as long as I'm asking for personal reactions to what happened last week, an unusual thing happened to me. I was surprised. I watched what happened on Monday night, and I watched the news on Tuesday, and I found myself in a dark place, not depressed necessarily, but just in a dark place, and I didn't quite know what was going on. I mean, I don't have friends or family in Boston. God knows I'm not a runner. But then I realized I kept watching the scene of that man, that older man who we found out's about 70 who got knocked down at the bomb. And it's how vulnerable we are. And it just reawakened my own vulnerability, how things have happened to me, excuse me, out of the clear blue. And it's, you know, often we keep our vulnerability at arm's length. And I think an event like this kind of forces us to stare right at our own vulnerability.
I think that's absolutely the case, that we all have this response that, oh, this could have been me. Life is so fragile. And what does it mean? What's the meaning when these things can happen out of the blue? That sense of not having control. I think, you know, people like to have control. And this is a clear example of we don't have control over many things, including our health and sense of well-being at times.
So what do you do with that kind of vulnerability? I was thinking about this show, and you know, Erwin Yalom, the existential psychiatrist, who wrote a book about death and dying, and the title of the book is Staring at the Sun. Mm-hmm. Said to deal with your own death is like staring at the sun. You know it's there, but you can't stare at it. It hurts too much, and vulnerability seems to be the same thing. Yes.
I think so. I think it's, you know, we have to respect and acknowledge danger and our vulnerability in order to continue and to survive, which is our primary function. While at the same time, recognizing it is very painful. And this is the balance that we have to have. How do you recognize your vulnerabilities? How do you recognize your lack of control? While at the same time, recognizing that life has its meaning for you, and it's hard.
What did you do last? What impact did all this have on you last week, Steve?
Honestly, I think I was right back at when my career in this really started, was with 9/11, and I was really reviewing all the activities and all the various things I've responded to over the years, the school shootings and so on and so forth, and wondering about what I would be doing right now. What should I do? I immediately wanted to run to Boston, or that was not meant to be a pun, but yeah. I wanted to go to Boston right away, and recognizing that that wasn't, you know, what needed to happen. And I did contact some colleagues and let them know I'm available if they needed me, and also knew that Boston has probably one of the best response systems in the country. And I've been in contact with people, and I think it's knowledge, it's knowing that makes me feel better. And that's what I was looking for.
So what I'm hearing is a helplessness.
Yes.
On your part. But when you say you revisited all of your previous experiences, what happens? What happens to you, to a professional who's been there over and over? What impact does it have on you emotionally?
Well, I think I react like any normal human being, which was shock and terror and horror and wanting to hug my children, wanting my wife nearby. That's my first reaction, you know. And then the professional reaction kicks in of, you know, wanting to act, you know. And I think many of us have that response. You know, that's what happens after these events, where you see hundreds of people flooding in as volunteers and others, because we feel the need to respond in a pro-social, proactive way instead of just being passive and vulnerable.
Right, right. So your first reaction, like you said, like most normal humans, you wanted comfort. You wanted to be with people who could comfort you and vice versa.
Yes.
Nick, here in the studio. Nick, you were in the Boston Marathon. I'm told you finished 25 minutes before the explosion.
That's right, yes. I was still out in the street about three blocks away, and I heard the noises, and I think, like everyone is saying, you know, I wanted to make sense of it. I thought it might sound like a bomb, but hoped, of course, it wasn't. I thought maybe there's a building site that a wall collapsed or something, and it wasn't until about probably another half hour, 45 minutes, that we got confirmation that it was a bomb. So my first reactions were to get on the cell phone to my wife to make sure she was safe. I'd already arranged to meet her in the hotel, not at the finish line like she has other years. So I was grateful that I knew she was physically safe. And then, you know, I eventually met up with her. And then, of course, we started seeing all the police and other activity that just kicked into high gear extremely quickly. But the next 24 hours in the hotel was pretty surreal with, you know, police in flak jackets and assault rifles, etc., when it should be a time celebration. And it put the race in perspective.
Yeah, you used the word surreal, and I think it was that way for all of us. Tell us about, you said you didn't know for a half hour. I want to know what those first 2 hours were like for you, right after you found out.
Found out that it was a bomb?
Yes.
I think, like everyone else, it was shock. I'd been fortunate enough to run the marathon a few times before, and to have an event that should be a total celebration turned into what obviously became a national tragedy was just, it was shocking. And a lot of the next couple of hours was just trying to find information. Should we stay in the hotel? Could I get back to the hotel? Well, yes, fortunately I could and found my wife, like I said. But it really was a time of just trying to figure out what next, and relying at that stage obviously on authorities and instructions, and no, you can stay here, you don't have to leave, in fact we don't want you to leave, etc. So it was a lot of, I imagine, like after a death where people are so taken up in the practical arrangements that you don't have time to process it quite as much at that stage. You're just dealing with the immediate.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking about the impact of the events in Boston last week on all of us, the emotional impact, our vulnerability. Some of us may feel fear, some of us may not. I'm talking with psychiatrist Steve Berkowitz, who specializes in trauma. We were just talking with Nick, and we might come back and chat with you some more. Nick is here in the studio with us, and Nick finished was in Boston, crossed the finish line about a half hour before the bombs went off. And I want to talk about some of the subsequent emotions. But if you want to join our conversation, please give us a call. We are at 888. I just lost a number. How do you like that? I've only been doing this for 30 years. 888-477-9499. Let's go to the phones. We've got Megan on the line.
Hi, this is Megan.
Hi, Megan. What can we do for you?
Well, I'm also a marriage family therapist, and I'm in Pennsylvania right now, and I was absolutely horrified in the beginning, and then this whole last week was over the top. How you described how people were transfixed for the last week, the images of being replayed on every major network, everything was way over the top, and it was awfully depressing. And it should not have happened that way. I think the media needs to take some responsibility. People needed information, but not 24/7.
So let's talk about, if we may, Megan, talk about
you.
So,
me? Okay.
Yeah, I want to know.
It depressed me on Sunday. I finally went to meeting, the Downingtown Quaker meeting, and I cried because I was so depressed after trying to get some kind of news of other things or even TV, just relief of something, and got nothing but picture. You know what I mean? It was not okay. Is that what you wanted?
Well, yeah. Or how are you today?
I'm actually walking my golden retriever right now.
Uh-huh.
I just, we talked about it in meeting very briefly. And we all basically came, oh, there's going to be some barking maybe. We basically came to the conclusion it was just over the top.
Well,
there was just too much.
I appreciate your call, Megan. I'm going to follow that up with Steve Berkowitz. Steve, you spoke when we were chatting earlier about a study that you cited about people who watch media tend to be in worse shape.
Yeah, there are several studies after 9/11, after the Oklahoma City bombing, that showed that people who watched more TV or more social media about these events actually were more symptomatic, had more traumatic stress symptoms, experience depression to a greater extent. I think those are complicated because who's drawn to watch it over and over again. But I also think that we as human beings are drawn to making sure that we can protect ourselves against dangers, and so we're drawn to the very things that we fear in order to make sure that we can protect ourselves.
Well, it's also, though, I mean, we heard from Nick just now, when you were in the hotel. I mean, you just wanted information. You needed information. And there's a way in which we all felt that way in the wake. We need information. I mean, for you to need information, Nick, the reason for that is obvious. I mean, you needed structure and guidance in your life, but we all felt we needed it. That need comes from the same place it did with Nick.
I think that's true, and I think it's about knowing what to do, how to stay safe. Nick clearly wanted to know, what do I do to keep myself safe? Do I need to stay? Do I need to leave? And I think many of us feel that way even from a distance. What do I do? How do I feel safe? And so we watch every bit of it. And particularly this story where, unlike many of the previous incidences like this where people, we knew the perpetrators were dead, this was ongoing. And so that sense of threat continued.
We're going to have to take a short break. And when we come back, we're going to talk more about what happened to all of us, how to resolve it, and maybe what the media's job is in all of this. You know, Steve, your study about, you know, the media and watching too much media, I want to review the fine details of that. I can't believe that applied to NPR. So I only said that because the boss is here in the studio. So anyway, we'll be back in just 60 seconds. We're talking with psychiatrist Steve Berkowitz, associate professor of psychiatry at University of Pennsylvania. He runs the Penn Center for Youth and Family Trauma Response and Recovery. If you want to join the conversation, we're at 888-477-9499. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
Devereaux is a proud supporter of WHYY. For more than 100 years, Devereaux has been providing services to individuals with developmental disabilities and mental and behavioral health disorders. Founded locally by pioneering schoolteacher Helena Devereaux, the organization now helps individuals across our nation to live healthier, happier, and more productive lives. Over the next 6 weeks, Wawa stores throughout southeastern Pennsylvania and New Jersey will help support Devereaux's work. More details at local Wawa stores.
Supporting WHYY, the Penn Program for Mindfulness will sponsor two mindfulness meditation events on May 10th and 11th, exploring mindfulness and meditation as powerful tools for personal growth and transformation. Events will include a Friday evening lecture by Sharon Salzberg about mindfulness meditation and a half-day workshop on meditation as a tool for compassion. For information on all programs offered, online at pennmedicine.org/mindfulness or 215-615-2775.
I was raised in London and was raised during the time of the IRA bombings. I was actually at Harrods when the Harrods bombings occurred. In Europe, we've been living with these kind of incidents for a while, and it seems that they've come to the United States.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about the events of last week in Boston, but we're talking about them from a very, very personal perspective, because those who are listening to this show, those who have been watching the news and riveted to the story, are having a deeply personal reaction. It's not simply curiosity or interest. So the stories we're hearing are personal ones, and we're going to hear about stories of healing also. I've got a live audience here in the studio. We're also taking calls here at 888-477-9499. And we're talking with psychiatrist and trauma expert Steve Berkowitz. Steve, what is trauma? Is it the out of Forrest Gump, trauma is as trauma does?
You know, trauma is Greek for injury or wound. And I think the best way to think about it is as an experience that causes an injury to our brains that reflects our emotional and intellectual functioning. And like most injuries, some are mild and take little to get better. Some need some intervention to get better, and some need significant intervention like surgery to get better, or, you know, psychotherapy. But it really, traumatic reactions really do unhinge us and make us react in all sorts of ways that we are not necessarily expecting. And I'm not just talking about PTSD, but there are a range of traumatic reactions that people have. They become more fearful or see danger where, you know, there may not be danger. They become more irritable. They feel isolated. There's all sorts of different reactions to these kind of upsetting, overwhelming events.
Is there anything that makes it predictable who is more likely to have a strong reaction?
There are some predictive kinds of factors. certainly a history of previous trauma. A history of maltreatment and child abuse puts people at risk in these events. And then we know there are some genetic vulnerabilities now that some individuals have that make them more predisposed to have a more serious reaction to these events.
I wonder about what happens when it's a community event like this, like 9/11, even the tsunamis, mm-hmm. those kinds of things, rather than an individual event.
It really depends on the nature of the community event, and I think one of the things that we know is that terrorist events are much more likely to cause traumatic responses than, say, natural disasters. Mm. I think it's that nature of, again, of danger. Who could be doing this? You know, anybody's a threat. So I think that, and our rage, I think, over that we have when it's perpetrated intentionally, results in probably more of these kinds of traumatic responses. Typically, however, when it is a community, and we saw this in Boston, people come together in a way that when it's an individual event, it doesn't naturally happen. We saw people who are running, who were officers and paramedics and nurses, you know, change their uniforms and run back to start aiding people. The responses from some of the runners who ran and to the hospitals to give blood. And communities come together in ways. I know that a group of students of several colleges, when the second perpetrator was apprehended, walked out and started singing the national anthem together. Those are the sorts of things that bring, that when communities come together and support each other, can be very healing. And we know from the literature that emotional support from caring people is one of the most protective factors.
You know, Steve, it gets back to what you said in the very beginning of the show. When you first got this news and you were traumatized might not be the right word, but all of those painful memories were opened up. What did you want? You wanted comfort.
Mm-hmm.
You wanted comfort. Nick, that sounded like that's what Nick wanted shortly, that we want comfort. So those students get the all clear and they find comfort with one another.
Yes.
Man, that's what we all want. We've got someone else in our live audience here who wants to chat. Adrienne?
Yeah, hi, Dan and Professor. I lived in Jerusalem in the 80s and 90s, and experiencing this incident via the press. But first, of course, I was addicted to the media, most like anybody else, and I reprimanded myself because I know that one of the coping mechanisms that Israelis have is to not fixate on watching, recaps of what happened and the minutia of how it happened and when it happened, but to go on living their lives. And of course it affects them, and they live in a sense of immediacy of many of them were traumatized by having it affect their families, but they band together. There is more of a sense of family and community, but they in Israel and here I feel a sense of sadness that Americans are getting much more familiar with what it's like to live in a place that where you have a loss of innocence and you know that it could happen anytime again. And it can happen anytime again. Israelis realize that there's no way to prevent a very determined terrorist from doing their acts. Unfortunately, even with a sophisticated intelligence community like the Mossad, there's no way to prevent it. So they have to go on living their lives and just hugging their kids and going to work and not fixating on it, as a matter of course.
Yeah, we're back to that issue of comfort again, and turning off the TV. I gotta tell you, I trash technology way more than I should, but I've got news on my iPhone, and I get these push notifications so that when something happens, they notify me. So I'm comfortable turning it off now. And if there's some real change, they tell me. I don't have to go after it. And it really helped me. Mm. Helped me turn off the TV for a while, except for NPR, of course. Is he watching? Let's go to the phones. We've got Tina on the line. Hi, Tina.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, how are you?
I'm good. My comment is that I, you know, afterwards, after all of the news and after they actually capture the person, you know, who committed this, dead or alive, like Osama bin Laden, everything, anyone, there's a lot of celebration that goes on. You see it on TV. I saw it around me. And I absolutely just can never get myself to even think about celebrating because it's, for me, it's such, the whole thing is so sad. And,
yeah.
It's just depressing that human beings can be so angry and then in such jubilation of someone's death. The whole thing is very upsetting, and I can't get to a point of celebrating, even if it's a horrific situation. And they found the person who committed the crime.
Let me ask you a question. If I was a magician, tell me what you would like me to do that would help you feel better. What do you need?
That's a magical question.
Well, yeah.
What would I just think it would be giving the facts, describing the yearning that I have is the why question. Why this, or and how does someone get to that point where they can decide to kill one person or several people? And I think that satisfies the uncomfortableness that I have about it.
Well,
and kind of allows it to clink around in my head in a different way versus this, you know, going back to the heart, pulling on the heartstrings and the celebrating and all of that.
Okay. Well, thank goodness we've got an expert here, so I don't have to answer any of those tough questions. But,
who are you talking about?
Let me just say this to you, Tina. You know, your bottom line that you just said was sadness. And I think, you know, if we can process all the information and just sit with it, I think that's where we're going to wind up. Because there is evil. People are capable of doing it. There is meanness. We can, I don't know if the word celebrate, but kind of rejoice in closure, in reclamation of our lives back. And all of that is sad. And we're going to talk later about what happens to a 19-year-old boy that this happens, or younger kids. So, all right, so let's turn to the expert. And Tina, thanks for your call.
I'm not sure I can say it better than you did. I think the celebration... And I almost see it as a relief, is the kind of celebrating that one has when they're relieved that something is done and over. And as you review all of that, and I think even as you feel relief or you celebrate, there's also that sense of guilt that Tina mentioned, and that brings you right back to that sense of feeling sad. Overwhelmed, how could this be? And how could I actually feel anything positive, even relief, as a result of all of this?
There's a wonderful line in a poem about how sadness, opens us up,
yeah,
to each other. Nick, I want to follow up with you. What was your reaction when they caught the second person, Johar?
Well, it was at one level obvious relief that, because the news reports had been saying that they might have a lot of weaponry still, or he might, obviously not his brother anymore. So yeah, I was very glad that they caught him. But I think some of the other reactions I've had trying to put this whole thing in perspective over the last week is to try and make sense of it. And I was interested in what Steve said about natural disasters, because since Monday we've had the earthquake in China, which killed far more people, injured over 11,000 last I heard. There was the explosion in West Texas, which killed a lot more people. Last night there were 5 shootings in Seattle. So, but we know that the reaction by far has been strongest to the marathon bombings, and the only way I can figure it, it's because it is an assault on the national psyche, almost, that, and that's, and the unpredictability of it. But yeah, I'm glad the guy's caught.
Tell me how you are today, Nick.
I think I'm okay. I'm not 100% sure. I know I wasn't okay when I went back to work on Wednesday, because on Thursday, people told me how awful I looked the day before, and I hadn't realized. On Tuesday, I was traveling back from Boston with my wife, so again, that was just practical stuff had to be got through. But then Wednesday, I realized that I was in at some level of shock, and I think I'm trying to make sense of it. I'm coming to terms as much as one can.
Yeah, and you know, like Tina said, looking for information, right. Always looking for information. I mean, that's why this whole country is anxious to hear what comes from the interrogation, if anything, so that we can somehow find peace in all this. We're going to have to take a short break. We're talking about our emotional reactions, our very personal emotional reactions in the wake of what happened in Boston last week. We're talking with psychiatrist Steve Berkowitz. We're with a live audience here in the studio. Our number is 888-477-9499. And when we come back, I want to talk with you about how some people kind of stay in crisis while others are able to compartmentalize. We used to think that was a dirty word, but now we find that compartmentalization can be a good thing. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY FM.
Supporting WHYY, Camp Hill Special School, with day and residential options, is a community committed to the care and education of children ages 4 through 21 with mild to severe intellectual disabilities. Dr. Dan Gottlieb makes a presentation at their Phoenixville campus on April 22nd, and the school hosts an open house at their Glenmore campus on April 27th. To register for the presentation on April 22nd and the open house on April 27th, and for more details, camphillspecialschool.org.
WHYY's Quiet Campaign is underway. Do your part now to take a day off the start of our spring on-air membership drive. Make your gift at whyy.org/support. Our goal is to raise $25,000 before midnight on Tuesday. And if we make that goal, we'll keep Pledge Central quiet all day Wednesday. Join the Quiet Campaign. Make your gift now at whyy.org/support.
It is very sorrowful, and I pray that this will not happen again.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb. We're talking about trauma, last week's trauma in Boston specifically, and what impact it's had on all of us. We're here with a live audience in the studio who've been very, very quiet and polite, and very nice people who haven't made a fuss yet. It's okay to make a fuss. You know, you're all going to get stars on your paper after this. I'm also joined by Steve Berkowitz, friend of mine, psychiatrist, who's been less quiet and polite, and he's not going to get a star on his paper after this. Steve, I want to know about people who stay in it versus people who are able to compartmentalize. You know, this phenomenon of looking at media over and over and over again, it just sounds like picking at a scab.
I think that's a great analogy. I think, again, that we are so want to be in control. We want to know what happened. We want to understand people's motivations. It's a way of making sense out of really trying to be in control of the situations, even when we're not. And so we're drawn to these images, to these to the media. Anything that can change how we feel, anything that can help us feel like we're in control. And unfortunately, we know it doesn't work very well when we do that. What we do know that is helpful are those people, as you said, who can compartmentalize. It's not like it goes away, but can actually resume their normal lives and normal routines. I'm well trained in doing that. I have to do it in order to function, frankly. And
don't we all, to a certain extent?
Absolutely.
Really?
Absolutely.
You know, I said to somebody the other day, I mean, if we took in all of the data, we'd have to be fools to get in our cars, literally.
Yeah, absolutely true. And we have to live in the moment. We have to live, you know, day by day in order to go on, or, you know, we become paralyzed. And we do see people become paralyzed.
Hmm. Margaret, here in the studio, had a question or comment. Oh, hi, Margaret. Wait till the microphone.
It's come to my attention that Mr. Rogers says his mother told him to always look for the helpers when there was a terrible situation, and it seems to me that Dr. Dan is our Philadelphia helper, and also Steve Berkowitz.
Thank you. Let's talk about those helpers. Steve, you're one of them in a way that's different than the way I am. What happens to helpers?
Well, I actually was on the phone last night with a colleague of mine who's leading the psychological response, and we were talking just about that. We were talking, one, about the first responders who, you know, arrived on scene and were really quite overwhelmed. I don't know if people know this, but it took 4 days to clean up the blood, and people were covered in blood, the first responders, and many of them are quite symptomatic, and they are the helpers.
When you say symptomatic, what do you mean?
They're having a very hard time. They're not, you know, not sleeping, feeling very anxious. We know that one of the big issues for first responders after events like this is increased use of alcohol. Which can be a real dilemma. And so we have to pay attention to them a great deal. Folks like me who arrive on scene, we've set up systems to support each other, and that's absolutely crucial. And the support that first responders get, psychological first responders, it's absolutely crucial to have that already in preparation. For these events, you have to have it, and you have to be able to really talk to your colleagues about what they've experienced and what they're feeling, much like we're doing today.
Care.
Yes.
Even if things don't change, care helps us get through it.
Absolutely.
I wonder about kids. And when this happened, I was reminded, my daughter, Allie, was about 10 or 12 years old. during the MOVE bombings in Philadelphia. And for those who don't know it, there was a radical Back to Nature group in West Philly. They were creating a great deal of havoc. The mayor decided to bomb their bunker. So there it was. And there was a fire burning out of control. I was in bed at the time. And my daughter came in, sat on the bed next to me, and was watching this fire out of control. And she said, "Daddy, what's happening?" I had no idea how to explain it to them, to her. Tell me about kids. How do we help kids understand?
I think it's really a complicated question, because kids are, kids are not just kids. They at different developmental phases and ages. What they need and how they need to be talked to is quite different. So, younger children, under 6 and under, I think the basic response is, "I'm here to take care of you. I'm your parents, and we're going to take care of you, and you don't need to worry about this." Kids who are going to school and who are going to discuss this, what's really, I think, crucial is for parents to be there with them, and to one of the best things to do is to ask them what their friends are talking about, because often they won't tell you directly, but they'll certainly tell you what their friends are talking about, and to share with them your own responses in an appropriate way, but to process it, not to watch too much media, and to help them not do that, to suggest how to turn off your Facebook page and how not to get all those responses, and then for older adolescents, teenagers, really to share what their opinions are, and really to try to do again what we're doing here today.
Yeah, at some point it's not about talking, it's about asking.
That's right.
Let's get another call on. We've got Karen on the line.
Hello. I heard your guest a moment ago say he expressed some relief that the young man Jakar had been apprehended. And I know many, many, many people who feel, particularly those of us who are parents of young adult males, who feel tremendously, overwhelmingly saddened by the decisions these two young men made. We feel sad for the victims, for their victims, and justice must be done. But I picture this young man handcuffed to a bed with armed guards around him who will never know anything better than that. And there are many of us who are overwhelmingly saddened about the perpetrators, not saying they shouldn't be dealt with, but we're saddened by whatever brought them to that point, and I'd like to hear your comments about that.
I want to follow that up. Thanks, Karen. I want to hear Steve's reaction. I got an email, and I just want to read one sentence. And it was written by a mother, and she refers to him and says, "He is in this mother's mind, though, a baby in so many ways, young boys and very young men, so fragile, so at risk. I just wish we could do something to save other young men from similar fates, but I'm at a loss."
I think we all feel that way. I mean, I think that's, goes back to the what I had said before about how you can feel relief, happy, and guilty and sad at the same time. And those emotions are, all part of us. And I think many of us feel the same way, that it's terrible. I remember after Columbine, the parents' reactions, and wondering if these children are even theirs, and how they could bring them into the world. So I think these are very difficult responses, and very difficult things for parents of kids this age, who, as we know, are vulnerable, and vulnerable to all sorts of things.
And our first reaction might be hatred, and that's almost adaptive. It protects us from the more painful, more vulnerable emotions. But underneath that, here we are, you know, just all humans, all feeling vulnerable, and all of us needing what you talked about when we opened the show, needing comfort.
And I think hatred's a great word, because those strong emotions are strong emotions, and regardless, you know, they're flip sides of the same coins.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Steve, unfortunately, we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for coming down here on short notice, and especially thank you for what you do for a living and helping shed so much light on this important topic. We've been talking about how we feel in the aftermath of the Boston bombings tragedy with Steve Berkowitz, our listeners over the phone. And to you, our wonderful audience, thank you so much for coming out. Give yourselves a round of applause here. Just needed to prove to the listening audience that you were really here. Next week on Voices in the Family, we're going to look at our capacity to connect socially in the high-tech age that we currently live in. We'd love to hear your reaction to today's show. We're at whyy.org/voices, and you can also download this show there or other Voices show on that webpage or on iTunes. We are at Twitter at Voices in the Fam, and I'm at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez-Loon is our executive producer of audio content and helped with the mic here in the studio audience. Emily Haas is our production assistant. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Jennifer Lynn is our producer and did a great job pulling the show together on short notice. Special thanks to Joyce Lieberman, Art Ellis, Christine Dempsey, Julian Hertzfeld, Jeff Bundy, Rich Banowitz, Sarah Kazar, Scott Larkin, and the music of Trevor Gordon Hall. Hey, I'm Dan Gottlieb. Please take care, my friends.